This is Hashtag History, episode 85. I'm Rachel.
And I am Leah.
And we are in for a doozy this week. So, you know, just get comfy because we're going to talk about some really uncomfy stuff this week.
We're both so comfy.
We're always comfy. We record at Leah's house and I show up in basically pajamas every week.
And I love it. And I'm also wearing pajamas.
But it's your home, so it's a little more acceptable. I literally show up to your house in slippers.
But I love the fact that, like, you feel comfortable enough to, like, come to my house and wear slippers.
You've seen me every which way.
Yeah.
You've seen it all.
Yeah, and I like it.
I mean, I enjoy this too. Actually, speaking of being uncomfy, we don't generally do like a content warning in each of our episodes, despite the fact that pretty much every single one of our episodes does include some sort of sensitive topics. Mm-hmm. But I feel we need to give a content warning before diving into this week's episode because it contains some exceptionally sensitive topics. These topics include child abuse, animal mutilation, suicide, and more. Mm. We don't go into any detail whatsoever about any of those topics, but even if the mention of them is too sensitive for you, we totally get it. And we will see you next week when we drop a brand new awesome episode.
Yeah.
But for those that are sticking around, this week we are discussing the Satanic Panic, which spanned the 1980s into the 1990s here in the United States. It was a phenomenon that alleged that mass child abuse across the United States all had ties back to satanic cults. This phenomenon originated with the 1980 publication of a book titled Michelle Remembers, in which a woman wrote of her journey of undergoing memory therapy and alleging that she had discovered repressed memories of years of satanic ritualistic abuse. This moral panic was exacerbated a few years later in 1983 when a woman here in California accused her son's preschool, the McMartin Preschool, of abusing him. The McMartin Preschool trial would become the longest and most expensive criminal trial in American history. Mm. Over the course of the Satanic Panic, these satanic ritual abuse theories would extend to alleging that teachers were engaging in human sacrifices, that McDonald's was funding the Church of Satan, that listening to rock music was a sure sign that you were a devil worshiper, and so much more. Mm. People would serve time behind bars for the unsubstantiated alleged crimes, and families would be torn apart forever. At the end of the day, there would be more than 12,000 accusations made across the country, with not a single one of them containing verifiable supporting evidence. I think this is a good place for me to insert that we honestly could have made this week's topic a six-part series. In fact, there is a really amazing series about the Satanic Panic on the Uncover podcast that I highly recommend. I just wanted to mention that this is an abridged version of the Satanic Panic. We really could be here all week talking about this, but I've shortened it to more of a bite size and wanted to address that up front because there are some areas of the story that I did have to do more cursory coverage just so I could fit it all in. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, we still have so much to get into this week. It's morbid to say that I'm looking forward to it, but the truth is I am.
We are who we are.
We are who we are. Likewise, I'm looking forward to this cocktail that we have in front of us.
Are you really?
Mm-mm. I wrote that before I knew what was in it. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History,
the podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
Okay. This cocktail was sponsored by our friend Stephanie, once Yay! Again from Beyond Reproach. In addition to saying thank you so much for sponsoring two cocktails in a row, I'd also like to use this as a shameless plug for Beyond Reproach, who has an amazing, amazing podcast you all should go listen to.
I say this to Tux, who's one of the hosts. I say this to him all the time. If some big network could pick up any indie podcast, I would recommend theirs before our own. They are such an amazing podcast.
They do such good research.
So polished, so professional.
Yeah.
Their banter is great. Mm-hmm. Their cocktails are
much, much nicer than ours.
I mean, they are. They are. No, they're amazing.
No shame. No shame here.
They're amazing. So please go listen to them. If you like our podcast, you will end up loving theirs more. So go check them out.
Okay. Now that that's out of the way, let's get into this cocktail. So
or we cannot.
Yeah. She's not excited.
Because it's brown.
Today, yeah. So today we're drinking a cocktail I found called Satan's Whiskers. because I found the name funny.
Yeah. To be honest, when I was putting together the research for this episode, like half of my excitement, I guess I'll say, about putting together the episode was anticipating what you were going to put together for the cocktail.
Well, sorry I let you down with this. Because
Satan's Whiskers.
Well, okay, the name might save it, but the ingredients do not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it contains dry gin, vermouth, Grand Marnier or some other orange liqueur, orange juice, which, okay.
We do love OJ.
And orange bitters. So let's get into Satan's Whiskers.
I think I'll pass. Cheers.
It's actually, I would say, one of the better vermouth drinks we've ever had.
Are we growing? No. Are we changing as people? Are we maturing?
Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, my skin is. I like it.
You like it. It's.
Okay. I would go the step that's above tolerable. That's where I'm at. Well, yeah. There's tolerable. There's neutral. There's neutral with, I kind of like it. That's where I'm at.
Okay. That's where I'm at.
That's a six.
That's a six.
That's a six, which is maybe the highest we've ever rated a gin and vermouth.
Who are we?
We're adults.
Is it the OJ?
Or we're just maturing.
I don't believe that.
We're on season 9.
Yeah.
Maybe we're maturing.
We're old.
Yeah, we're just old as dirt
now. I like gin now. Oh, that's true. Mm-hmm. I've matured into liking gin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cheers.
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 Well, cheers to Satan's Whiskers.
Mm-hmm. Not as scratchy as I expected.
All right, so let's do some background on how America, how she's doing.
How's she
this time? How's she doing at this time?
How's she doing now?
We're gonna
breeze past that.
Yeah, we're gonna deflect from right now.
Okay.
And talk about the past.
Okay.
Because this context does really matter to the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Statistics show that the 1980s and 1990s were the greatest time in American history for the working woman. In fact, yeah,
work.
In fact, for some context, following World War II, roughly 10% of married women with children were working outside of the home. Come 1986, more than 50% of married women with children were in the workplace. Working women were reflected in the media regularly, with sitcoms that had, you know, previously depicted mothers as housewives now depicting moms that worked outside of the house in elevated positions such as doctors and lawyers and architects and whatnot.
Nice.
Pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
The influx of women working outside the home led to a change in the more traditional family dynamics. An obvious result of more mothers working outside of the home was that there was a greater need for external childcare.
Fourth R, bitches.
Fourth R. As I know many mothers still feel to this day, in the 1980s, there was a particular level of guilt that many of them felt sending their children to be taken care of by someone else during the daytime. And this guilt and the uncertainty surrounding it is going to become very important later.
Mm.
It's also important to note that this change in the familial and societal realms is happening simultaneously with the 1980s return to more fundamental Christianity. Following the New Age, more, you know, spiritualism context of the 1960s and 70s, the Reagan era of the 1980s saw a shift back to more conservative Christian religious values. A final thing to mention here about the 1980s is that this was a time when awareness about child abuse finally became a thing. Prior to this time period, there were not many systems in place to help protect children. In fact, prior to this time period, things such as child abuse and incest were oftentimes overlooked and disregarded. The 80s saw the implementation of mandatory reporting laws, the first comprehensive federal Child Protective Services Act, and more. As I mentioned in the intro, the publication of a particular book would be the start of this massive wave of satanic panic. In 1980, a book titled Michelle Remembers was published. This book was written by a Canadian psychiatrist named Lawrence Pazder and his psychiatric patient, who had also eventually become his wife.
Ew!
He was married when he first started seeing her.
That's like one of the that's really abuse of power.
Yes.
That's like one of the most severe abuses of power ever is when the shrink ends up doing their...
Manipulating patient.
Yes.
Yes. So yeah, that's who we're talking about here. So his patient was a woman named, and then later wife, was a woman named Michelle Smith. The book follows Smith's journey of memory therapy, in which she recounted years of satanic ritualistic abuse. Smith would originally seek treatment for her depression from Dr. Pazder, but these therapy sessions would end up taking a hard left. They'd take a hard left turn into something much, much darker.
Ugh.
Over the course of 14 months, they would end up recording approximately 600 hours of audio from their sessions, in which Smith would speak in an almost childlike, hypnotic state about her childhood memories. You look uncomfy. Yeah.
I don't know what to say.
Yeah. I mean, what is there to say? She would tell stories of being kidnapped by a satanic cult, which involved horrendous tales of child abuse and animal mutilation. The thing about these so-called memories is that they contained information that could be very easily debunked. For example, one of these memories included a fatal car crash that had occurred in British Columbia, which, upon checking records, there was no such record of this accident ever happening. Additionally, one such memory of Smith's included a satanic ritual at the Ross Bay Cemetery Mausoleum in Victoria with like way too many people than could actually fit in that space. It was this whole elaborate story of hundreds of people over the course of multiple days met here at this cemetery to, you know, engage in satanic rituals. It's like that many people could never fit there. And also there would probably have been more publicity around that if that had happened over the course of multiple days.
Yeah, that was going to be my first my first question I was going to ask is there any proof that substantiates these claims?
Not only is there no proof to substantiate, over and over again, they were debunked.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, like, facts don't matter, right?
What?
Dr. Pazder and Smith published a book recounting all these memories that, you know, I already talked about, titled Michelle Remembers, and told the world that these had all been real experiences that she only realized were real when Dr. Pazder had hypnotized her and brought them out of her.
Mm.
She told in the book about how she had been kidnapped by a satanic cult, locked in a cage, tortured physically, assaulted sexually, witnessed human sacrifices, and more. She explained for any doubters that the reason she no longer bore scars from this torture was because Jesus had removed them.
Oh.
And unfortunately, the general public gobbled this up.
Mm.
Essentially, what this book did for the general public was create the link between child abuse and satanic rituals, and it coined the term ritual abuse. It gave your average American citizen a scapegoat. It allowed people to think that their family and friends couldn't possibly be child abusers, that only those involved in the occult could possibly be behind something so horrendous. The book would become an instant bestseller and would earn the authors more than $1 million in today's money. Despite the fact that this book has since been discredited and proven entirely false, it was used as a resource for many prosecutors throughout the 80s and would lead to Dr. Pazder being consulted as an expert for more than 1,000 satanic ritual abuse cases.
1,000?
Yeah, more than 1,000. We're only getting started.
Oh my God, you're going to be annoyed with my facial expressions.
I love them. They're my favorite part of doing this podcast together.
I'm glad.
Nearly 10 years after the book's publication, Smith would appear on the Oprah Winfrey Show, in which her claims of satanic ritual abuse would be delivered to the audience as hard facts.
I want to see that episode.
Yes. So we hate all of that.
Yeah, we do.
We do. One such case that Dr. Pazder would be consulted for was that of the McMartin preschool case.
I'm already angry.
Oh, stay angry. Hashtag stay angry. In 1983, a young boy who was enrolled at the McMartin Preschool in Manhattan Beach, California, was having issues with painful bowel movements.
Yeah.
His mother, Judy Johnson, alleged that the painful bowel movements were the result of her son having been sexually abused by a teacher at the McMartin Preschool. You feel like that's a large leap?
Well, if there's other things that are pointing to that, then no. But like, if he's literally, the only thing is he's having weird bowel movements. Large leap.
Mm-hmm.
Get some Pepto.
Abused by a teacher at the McMartin preschool, Ray Buckey, a man who was in his 20s, who was also the son of the owner of the preschool. Johnson reported this all to the police, who subsequently sent out a letter to approximately 200 parents who had children at the McMartin school. This letter is pretty long, so I've kind of like cut it down. Would you like to read it?
This department is conducting a criminal investigation involving child molestation. Ray Buckey, an employee of Virginia McMartin's preschool, was arrested September 7th, 1983 by this department. Records indicate that your child has been or is currently a student at the preschool. We are asking your assistance in this continuing investigation. Please question your child to see if he or she has been a witness to any crime or if he or she has been a victim. Our investigation indicates that possible criminal acts include oral sex, funneling of genitals, buttock or chest area, and sodomy, possibly committed under the pretense of taking the child's temperature. Also, photos may have been taken of children without their clothing. Any information from your child regarding having ever observed Ray Buckey to leave a classroom alone with a child during any nap period, or if they have ever observed Ray Buckey tie up a child, is important. If I received this
as a parent,
I would lose it.
Of course you would. In hindsight, we can see that that was completely inappropriate. For a police department to send that out to 200 parents.
And give them details about the case that they're investigating, obviously. Yes.
And then imagine as a parent, your child may or may not have been sexually assaulted.
Mass hysteria, I'm sure.
Ooh.
Mass hysteria ensued.
And rightfully so, mm-hmm. if you were a parent that received that letter.
100%. Hunapee.
The Children's Institute International conducted hundreds of interviews as a result of this letter going out. And the way these interviews were conducted was absolutely atrocious, with the investigators asking the children very much leading and suggestive questions. As opposed to more open-ended questions like, what happened? These children were posed with questions like, listen, we already know what happened, so now tell us about it. You can actually listen back to some of the audio recordings from these interviews. You wouldn't want to.
No.
And they're atrocious. Some of these interviews lasted for hours with children.
Yeah.
The percentage of time that the investigators are speaking significantly outweighs the amount of time the children were speaking. And many times you can hear the children actually directly refuting the words the adult is attempting to put in their mouths. Multiple times. I've listened to some of them because... like we suggested early on in the episode, the Uncover podcast has done a really great series on the Satanic Panic. And mm-hmm. in that series, they do play some of the audio. So I have heard it.
Yeah.
And over again, you hear the children being like, what are you talking about?
Like, no.
Over and over.
Yeah.
However, you know, the children were rewarded for telling the investigators what they wanted to hear. And when a child refused to corroborate the abuse allegations, they were told that they were just too scared to tell the truth.
This is f***ing bullshit.
Yes. There's actually this one really great story about this child that was shown like a lineup of photos that the investigator had hoped would help the kid, you know, like point out and single out the suspect. Tell me why the child ended up picking out a photo of Chuck Norris.
Yes.
Okay. Chuck. Like there's a little bit of levity right there. Like that's pretty funny.
That's funny. He's like, I recognize this one.
Exactly. He's a child.
Yes.
And I think it probably goes without saying that the interviewing techniques used at this time are now the exact opposite of what is currently established here in California for interviews with child witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of it all, in March 1984, the investigators determined that more than 350 McMartin students had been sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
These conclusions were not made on physical evidence, but rather on the testimony of the children. And it was widely believed in the 1980s that children did not lie about things such as abuse, and therefore these accounts must be true.
And I think saying that they were lying is also like a disservice to the children because they were manipulated into yes. saying these things.
Yes. And I just think it's so interesting how far, like, you know, children's education has come, you know, the development of children's education has come in that. This is 30 to 40 years ago, there was this belief that, like, kids couldn't lie. But, like, I mean, didn't you lie as a kid?
Oh, yeah.
Of course you lied as a kid.
Like, did I eat that donut? Yeah, I did.
But did you say you did?
No.
That's what I'm saying. And but there was just child education development was not at the place that it is now then. And so there was this belief that like children would never lie when it comes to something like abuse. But of course they were put in these situations where they were rewarded for lying.
I was going to ask you like, how were they rewarded? Was it just like, good job.
Okay. You've done so great.
Okay.
You can hear that over and over in the audio recordings. Good boy. Good girl. Good job.
Mm-hmm. Ew. Ew.
Over and over.
Ew.
We've told you all before, time and time again, that we are a part of a book club.
What? We have? Have we mentioned that?
Yeah, I think at least 500 times.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Something else we mentioned a lot is how as grown adults with full-time jobs, a side podcast gig, and other everyday responsibilities, it can be hard to find the time to read.
Right. So that's why we oftentimes use audiobooks, and Audible is a great resource for that.
Audible is the leading provider in spoken word entertainment and audiobooks. They have titles ranging from news, self-development, business, fiction, and more.
Not only do they have audiobooks, they also have podcasts, wellness guidance programs like guided meditations, and more.
The best thing about Audible is that you can download titles to listen to offline, anytime and anywhere across all devices without losing your spot.
And Audible has thousands of titles for you to choose from. Maybe pick one of our recent favorites, such as The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires by Grady Hendrix.
Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow.
That was a good one. I love that one. Try out a free 30-day trial now when you use our link at www.audibletrial.com/history.
That's www.audibletrial.com/history.
Something that's worth noting is that authorities didn't immediately jump to the conclusion that satanic ritual abuse was at the heart of these cases. It would eventually reach that point, though, when children started telling wild stories about witches, about how they had witnessed other children being flushed down the toilet.
Okay. Because that's possible.
Okay. Even stories about these sexual encounters with adults occurring in the tunnels beneath the McMartin preschool. It should be noted that later on, there was an investigation conducted in relation to these tunnels, and it was found that there were no tunnels.
Of course there weren't, because that's a child's f***ing fantasy. Like, you know what I mean? It's like a story. They're using their imagination and then getting rewarded. Of course they're going to like...
If you think of the wildest story as a child, like, that happened. And it happened in these underground secretive tunnels.
Reminds me of Halloween Town.
Mm-hmm.
Marnie.
Marnie and you Cal.
You get them. And Cal.
The most wild of the allegations came from none other than Judy Johnson, the woman that had started this all. She claimed that Bucky, the teacher at the school that had allegedly abused her son, could fly. She continued to blame Bucky for her son's abuse, despite the fact that her son was unable to identify Bucky in a lineup of photographs.
So Bucky did something to Judy. Judy's pissed that Bucky took her parking spot at Save Mart last week.
Well, this is a good segue because it's here that I'm going to note that Judy Johnson would eventually be diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And she had actually revealed this information to authorities early in the investigation. This information, however, was withheld from the eventual legal defense, despite the prosecution knowing about it from the start.
If you could see my face, people.
Her jaw is to the floor. Yeah. So all of these outrageous allegations would eventually lead to charges, which, you know, would then eventually lead to trial. In total, 7 employees at the McMartin preschool, which included Bucky, his mother, Peggy McMartin Bucky, and his sister, were all charged with hundreds of accounts of child abuse. This trial would begin in July of 1987, but would be dropped when the prosecution found that there was no physical evidence and that the statements of the children were too inconsistent. As a result, the prosecution decided to drop the charges against all but Bucky and his mother. In the meantime, the prosecution worked hard to collect evidence to back up their claims. One major source of evidence, and I use air quotes around the word evidence, was the witness testimony of a jailhouse informant named George Freeman. Freeman stated that while behind bars with Bucky had admitted to the whole thing. It should be noted, however, that the prosecution had granted Freeman immunity if he made this confession.
Mm-hmm.
And what does Freeman need immunity for, you ask me? Mm-hmm. Previous charges of perjury.
Mm.
AKA previous times that he had lied on the stand. So that makes like a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Let's get someone that has perjured himself so many times before that you have to offer him immunity in order to get him to essentially do it again.
Yeah.
3 years later, Peggy McMartin Buckey would be acquitted on all counts, but Ray Buckey would undergo a mistrial as two of the jurors stated that there was just not enough evidence in order for them to convict him.
Good. Thank you, you two jurors.
Thank you to those two. On May 7th, 1990, a second trial would begin, and by July 27th of that year, it would also end in yet another mistrial. This led the prosecution to finally just close the case and let Buckey go. After 8 years total and more than $15 million spent, making it the most expensive criminal trial in American history, and after Buckey had served 5 years behind bars without ever having been convicted of a crime, the McMartin preschool case was finally over.
I mean, I have so much to say. The criminal justice system is imperfect here in the United States, and I would argue everywhere.
Yep.
Like, there's
yeah,
no
sure
perfect system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm angry at the people that started this.
Yes. Yes.
I'm angry at that woman. Yes. Well, I mean, she was schizophrenic, but I'm angry at the woman, the people that took that woman's testimony as truth when they knew she was schizophrenic.
Yes.
And then pushed it and manipulated people into this thing that literally took 5 years of someone's life away from them.
And I would
and
argue
millions
to say
of taxpayer dollars.
And I would argue to say more than 5 years of his life. Do you imagine the rest of his life was peachy keen?
No.
Yes.
I'm sure he couldn't find a job. I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sure students no longer went to that school. I'm sure the school shut down.
And I think, you know, we're going to get into this more in this episode, but I think it's worth bringing up, and this is not a justification or excuse at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the satanic panic, why it became such a large thing is because it allowed people to disassociate. It allowed people to say, no, there's no way my brother-in-law is a child abuser, because only people that are in satanic ritualistic cults could possibly be behind something like this. And I understand that that's outrageous. I understand that that's like hard to for us to accept, but it did allow these people that were going through this moral shift, you know, with the family dynamics kind of changing, societal changes, religious changes, for them to have a scapegoat. So unfortunately, though, this case would inspire dozens of others. In 1992, Dan and Frances Keller, a couple that ran a daycare in Austin, Texas, they were sentenced to prison for charges of abusing children at their facility. This abuse included dismembering children and making children drink Kool-Aid that had been mixed with human blood.
Yeah, of course.
The Kellers would end up serving 20 years behind bars before being released when the coerced witnesses came forward and admitted that they had lied.
Mm-hmm.
One other particular case that needs mentioning is that of Andrew Chandler Jr., who was a bus driver from North Carolina convicted of child abuse in 1987. Like I said at the onset of this episode, this is an abridged version of the Satanic Panic. There's just no way that we can cover each and every case that came out of this horrible chapter in history.
Mm-hmm.
But Chandler Jr.'s case is worth particular mention because to this day, he is still serving time for these convictions.
Ugh.
There would end up being dozens of other cases that mirrored those of the McMartin Preschool, the Kellers, and Chandler Jr., spanning from California to Massachusetts to Florida. In the wake of this moral panic, it wasn't unusual for law enforcement agents and social workers alike to attend conferences about satanic ritual abuse, collect books and pamphlets about the occult, and even to refer to the Michelle Remembers book as a tool for training and education.
Eesh.
This fear of people walking around doing Satan's work didn't stop with child care workers. In fact, it extended far, far beyond that to include the government, political leaders, and corporations. One such corporation that people were convinced was heavily involved in the occult was none other than McDonald's. McD's. Apparently, it all started when some woman told the pastor of the church that she attended in Ohio that she had heard Ray Kroc, the CEO of McDonald's at the time, on a television show in which he said that he was a supporter of the Church of Satan, donating as much as 50% of McDonald's proceeds to the organization.
All right, let's find that clip from when he said that.
So, you know, that would be the appropriate and logical way to approach the situation. not what happened. Mm-hmm. Without actually watching the television show himself to confirm this information, the pastor published this information in the church's newsletter. And as they would say nowadays, it went viral. Other church newsletters started carrying the same story. It got so bad that McDonald's actually sent company executives out to local churches to testify that the allegations were false.
That's sad that they even had to do that.
I think they were just losing so much business that they felt in order to keep their business alive in these certain regions, they had to. McDonald's certainly was not the only scapegoat that got wrapped up in allegations of satanic ritualism. One major scapegoat for satanic ritualism was none other than Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. D&D, bitches. I played a round of D&D. Have I told you that?
No. Did you like it?
It was fine.
Was it addicting? Could it be addicting?
To teenagers, yes. Who want to escape their
reality.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1974, Dungeons and Dragons was released as a tabletop game. It was the first produced role-playing game. And I think, you know, most people are pretty familiar with D&D, but essentially you role play, right? So players get to role play as different characters and they use magic spells to fight off monsters or whatever.
Yeah, wizards, monsters. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a different storyline every time.
I like that.
Watch Stranger Things, people.
The game was not received well, though, by more conservative parents, and the disappearance of James Egbert played right into that. On August 15th, 1979, a student of Michigan State University, James Egbert, went missing and did sadly end up committing suicide. When it was revealed that he had been a big fan of the role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons, the media latched onto this as the reasoning behind the tragedy. It was alleged that because players of D&D can, quote, lose touch with reality, unquote, it was obviously from the devil and it was clearly Egbert's involvement with a satanic role-playing game that had led to him taking his own life. Following this incident, several parents would form a group called BAD, or like reading the acronym out all the way, B-A-D-D. It was Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons. This group would be at the forefront of the satanic panic craze.
Ugh.
And of course, we simply cannot move on from our discussion about how specific sources of entertainment media are from the devil without talking about rock music. Obviously. In May of 1985, 2020, you know, the award-winning American news program had a whole segment about how rock music was, quote, associated with devil worship. Well, if you watch back, if you watch Thriller, Michael Jackson's, the music video.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, it says, like, you know, thank you for watching my music video. I want it to be known that I am not involved in the occult in any way. Because Thriller, you know, the music video has zombies and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, at that time, you know, he had to distance himself from the occult and any kind of satanic panic. So I'm speaking of this, like, rock music, I'm sure that you've heard of back masking or backward masking. I've heard it both ways.
I don't know that I have.
It's essentially a recording technique where there can be like secret subliminal messaging.
Like the Beatles or Dark Side like of the Moon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's the idea that there can be these like secret subliminal messages in a song when it's played backwards. Many of those caught up in the satanic panic believe that heavy metal and rock bands were using backmasking to subconsciously convert young teens for satanic purposes.
Yes, because it's been proven that when you say a word backwards to me, it somehow manipulates me into knowing what your meaning is forwards.
When in fact, it just sounds like...
but no, I know what that means. Backwards.
You got it?
I got it.
How are you feeling?
Drunk on power.
Drunk on power. Half of that sentence is correct. Things reached a height in 1990 when the band Judas Priest was sued for supposedly encouraging two young men to commit suicide as a result of hearing these backmasking encouragements. In 1985, two men attempted to commit suicide after drinking, smoking, and listening to Judas Priest for several hours. One of these young men did sadly die, while the other miraculously survived, although he would forever live with a severely disfigured face from his gunshot wound.
Oh, wow.
Years later, the surviving man's family would sue Judas Priest, claiming that there had been subliminal messages to, quote, do it, unquote, in their Better By You, Better Than Me song. Unlike in the tragic McMartin preschool case, the judge would end up dismissing the case, stating that the subliminal messages did not appear to exist, and if they did, the band could not be held liable for the suicides.
This whole thing reminds me very much of the Salem witch trials.
Yes, it is the Salem witch trials.
And it's just, it's so unfortunate. It's just this frenzy, and it's this small group of people that like want attention. I hate to say that, but like want attention, mm-hmm. or like need something.
Yeah.
Are looking for something else in their life and find it in this thing and then exploit it and manipulate the people around them into also. But it's just like, literally the parallels between this are mm-hmm. astonishing.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It is the same thing. Now, of course, with 2020 hindsight, we can see that the Satanic Panic movement was absurd and so, so destructive.
Yeah.
And I hope it's not just with 2020 hindsight. I hope that I would recognize the absurdity and danger of it had I been an adult in the 80s. We talked about this during our, you just brought it up.
Yeah.
Our Salem Witch Trials episode, that we were like, where would we be in this moment in history? And we hope that,
I mean, let's be real, if we're in that moment, everything we're talking about is 2020 hindsight. Yep. And every time we say 2020 hindsight, I wonder if people moving forward are gonna, like, children are gonna think it means
the year 2020,
because that was such a year that, are they gonna think
that provided us with a lot of hindsight?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I'd like to think that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know.
I know. So I hope that I would have not been swept up in this craze.
Mm-hmm.
But of course now, you know, we may want to like roll our eyes at the whole debacle, but I do think there are a few things that we have to keep in mind. For those that believed ardently that there were devil worshiping people that sacrificed babies to Satan, we have to recognize that it was seemingly credible people that were giving them this information. Respected professionals like best-selling authors, world-renowned psychiatrists, experienced members of law enforcement, and intelligent legal minds
mm-hmm.
were all telling the average American citizen that Satan was all around and you just had to open up your eyes in order to see it.
Yeah.
Something else that I think is really important to understand is the context and the climate. As journalist Lisa Lottiser said, quote, "It's not just that parents were afraid of Satan, they were afraid, period." You have to remember that in the early 1980s, there were a lot of major shakeups in the traditional American family. Divorce rates had been surging since the 1970s, and more women were working outside the home than ever before. So for the first time, parents were trusting their children to strangers at daycare in great numbers. Plus, they often didn't know what their teenagers were up to after school because they weren't home to supervise them.
Mm.
This was legitimately worrisome for many. So when tabloid papers and TV talk shows started doing stories on satanic cults and devil worship, it was easy for them to believe this was a genuine threat and to be afraid for the safety of their kids, unquote. Excuses and passes at justification aside, the lasting legacy of the Satanic Panic is so, so tragic and so incredibly damaging. For the parents that truly did believe that their children had been abused, how did this affect their parenting? For the children that were convinced to believe that they had been abused as children, how did this affect them growing up? Psychologically, socially, and emotionally? What about the psychological effects on the children that were coerced into making false statements to law enforcement that would result in putting innocent people behind bars? Some of these children, now adults obviously, have spoken in more recent years about the guilt and shame that they feel over their involvement in these convictions. Looking at things from the flip side perspective, how many truly guilty people got away with child abuse because it was overlooked as the works of a grander satanic organization? The Satanic Panic obscured and distracted from the reality of child abuse by diverting time, attention, and resources away from the real predators. At the end of the day, there would be approximately 200 people charged with involvement in satanic ritual abuse, with dozens of them convicted and thrown behind bars. One such horrendous legacy of the Satanic Panic is that of the West Memphis Three, three teenage boys from Arkansas that were convicted of horrifically murdering three young boys, all because the teenage boys dressed in dark clothing and listened to heavy metal music. They were only just released from prison in 2011, and not because true justice had been served, but because they ended up entering an Alford plea, which is basically, like, in very simple non-legal terms, is a way of saying, I am innocent, but I understand that the prosecution has enough evidence to find me guilty. The judge accepted this plea and sentenced them to time served, releasing them after having served nearly two decades for crimes that they did not commit. Of the more than 12,000 accusations made as a result of the Satanic Panic of the 1980s, not a single one of them will be found to contain verifiable supporting evidence. Not a single one. Now, before we end this episode by feeling, you know, sort of good about this horrendous chapter in history being behind us, I just have to be honest that it's not.
Yeah.
Behind us, QAnon, the right-wing conspiracy movement that began in 2017, has adopted many of the sentiments of the Satanic Panic, accusing public liberal individuals such as actors and politicians as being the headmasters of a ring of child abuse, going so far as to say that these individuals are trafficking children, torturing them, and then using their blood for satanic rituals. As author Lawrence Wright is quoted as saying of QAnon members, "They see themselves as heroic, and how can you be heroic in today's world? Well, you protect the children. You protect the children against this cabal that is out to turn them into sex slaves. How could there be anything more important than that?" Unquote. It's misguided, harmful, and damaging, much like the Satanic Panic before it. Thank you for listening to this episode of Hashtag History.
All sources used to put together this episode can be found on our website at hashtaghistory-pod.com.
Subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use. Share about us with your family and friends. And then we would love it so much if you would head over to Apple Podcasts to give us a rate and review.
And be sure to check us out on our socials. We are on Instagram.
We're very social.
We're so social.
We're so social.
We're on Instagram at #history_podcast. We're also on TikTok. So check us out there at #history, all one word. And we're also on Twitter.
The tweeter.
At #history_. That's it.
That's it. And come join us over on Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can help support our books and booze supply. You also get access to some behind the scenes content, weekly hashtag hangout episodes, and we mail you cards and stickers.
That's right.
That's right. We do. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye.
Don't even need to count anymore, bitches.
In fact, there is a really great did I say it right? Did I say it funny enough?
Oh yeah.
But was I funny enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
100%. Hunnipee. For sponsoring All right. Ow, I just hit myself.
So bad. You know what we do have to be careful of? Vermouth. Remember?
I'm good.
Yeah, you're right. Mutilation. That's creepy. If I was like mutilation.
I'm just gonna take that sound bite.
It's gross. It's gross. Okay. The thing about these so-called memories, I'm laughing still.
I know, I can hear it.
I know,
in your
I need
voice.
To take that out. The thing about these so-called memories is that they contained information. No, I'm so good at this. I can't even take myself seriously. I'm so good at this. I really am so good at this.
Oh my god.
Oh god, this drink. Maybe it's down to a 4 again. Subsequently sent out. I just wanted to get your reaction.
Molestation.
Molestation.
They're criminally giving mullets to all the children.
That is a criminal offense. It is criminal. That actually made me cry.
I know,
have a
too.
Tear coming out of my
me
eyeball.
Too.
Mullet station. Okay. I think you just start all over.
I know.
Okay, I'm not going to look at you at all for the next paragraph.
I can't. Shh. This department, I can't.
This department is conducting a criminal investigation.
This department is conducting a criminal investigation involving child... Stop it.
And the way these... and the way these... Okay.
I hate me. I'm so I hate us.
Yeah. You hate... Yeah, you hate both of us.
You hate us. Yeah.
As opposed to more... That is...
I know. Wow. Like, shut the f*** up.
Nico could do whatever he wanted out there and it would not be heard over that.
Jesus.
What?